Welcome to All Things Marine, Hawaii's thought-provoking show dedicated to marine science and ocean conservation. All Things Marine, brought to you by Kosi Island Earth and the University of Hawaii, Hawaii Institute of Marine Biology. And now, here's your host, the marine science gal, Carly Weiner.
Aloha, I'm Carly Weiner, your marine science gal on the Tuesday, October 17th. And today we are going to be traveling along with Schmidt Ocean Institute's research vessel, Falkor, as they conduct work in the Phoenix Islands protected area. With a size of over 400,000 square kilometers, it is one of the largest marine protected areas in the world and the largest marine conservation effort of its kind by a least developed country. The Phoenix Islands is one of the largest and deepest UNESCO World Heritage Sites on Earth. Approximately the size of California, Phoenix Islands protected area was the first marine protected area of its kind. We are so lucky to be joined by three scientists today who are working on Falkor as it currently transits from Honolulu to the Phoenix Islands. Eric Cortez, Randy Rohan, and Chase Pacquiao, who are all joining this expedition. We'd first like to start with Chase, who joined the Phoenix Islands Protected Area team in 2010 and is a member of the Phoenix Islands Protected Area Scientific Advisory Committee.
Hi, Carly, this is Eric. Chase, I'm afraid, is down for the count. It's our first day out in the ocean, and he has discovered the wonders of seasickness.
Well, that's perfectly understandable. We definitely like to roll with, you know, the realities of sea life and being out at sea. And so that is something that happens to us. Well, we're really excited to have you, Eric. Dr. Eric Cortez is the principal investigator of the expedition and the associate professor and vice chair of biology at Temple University. Welcome to the program, Eric.
Thanks, Carly. It's good to talk to you.
Yeah, so why don't we start by just talking a little bit about the expedition and where the Phoenix Islands are and a little bit more about these islands.
Sure. So we just left port yesterday from Honolulu, and we will be steaming about 6 days to the south. We will be crossing the equator. We will be crossing the international dateline. In a few days, we will be arriving at the Phoenix Islands. It's a very small archipelago collection of islands just south of the equator with no permanent residents. There's only one island that is inhabited, and it has about 25 caretakers on board that live there temporarily. And it is the set of islands that is in the middle of the nation of Kiribati, which includes the Lyon Islands and the Gilbert Islands to the west of the Phoenix Islands. It is in the Phoenix Islands protected area, which one of my friends, Randy Rochin, will talk about a little more in a minute. And they are entirely unexplored in terms of the deep water fauna. So we are super excited to get out there and take the first look.
So this sounds like, I mean, this is right out of an adventure book. You're sailing right now to the middle of the Pacific Ocean and these really, really remote islands and going to be doing diving and exploration in areas that some people have never seen before.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it's really what it inspires me as a marine scientist and the things that I love to do the most. When I know that I'm looking at something that no other human eyes have seen before, it really is an exciting and just amazing experience, an amazing feeling. And we're going to be doing that for the entire trip. These are islands that people have been working on in terms of the shallow waters for some time and the shallow water corals. But the fact is that the majority of the protected area and the majority of the area that is owned by this country, Kiribati, is in the deep sea. And there's only been one really preliminary expedition that did some mapping and a few dives by the NOAA ship Okeanos Explorer, that happened earlier on this year, except they only did a little bit of mapping of the Phoenix Islands. They mostly focused on the islands and seamounts that are on the Tokelau Ridge, which lies a little bit to the west of the Phoenix Islands. And so this is entirely, you know, sight unseen. This is unexplored territory for anybody. So we don't really know what we're going to find, and I'm really excited to get our first glimpse.
Well, that's amazing, and I'm so excited to hear more about the science that you'll be doing. But let's talk about the transit first. So you've got 6 days now that you're going to be sailing, and so what really happens during those 6 days of transit? Are you preparing for the dives, or you know, are you just kind of sitting in anticipation waiting for our first robotic dive, or what's the mood like on board, and what is everybody doing in preparation for the science?
We're trying to get as much sleep as we can. to be honest, that is sort of part of it. We'll be doing 24-hour operations, and we will be absolutely exhausted at the end of this. But no, it's still a really busy time. We've been going through safety briefings and training on board the ship. This is a really new ROV that's only been on a couple of cruises. I got to participate in the science advisory group when it was getting put together, and it's really exciting to see it in person, the ROV Sebastian. And I'm really excited to get my hands on it and actually use it, but there's a lot to learn. Any new vehicle and any vehicle that you haven't used before, there are a lot of things to come up to speed on. You really need to have an intimate knowledge of the vehicle to be able to take advantage of it and use your time really wisely. So we're going to be spending a lot of time over the next few days just training on the vehicle and the control room and figuring out how to use it. We also need to go through all of our procedures in the wet lab and, you know, organize how samples are going to get processed, how we label things, how, you know, all of the details of how samples are taken and how science is done. And on top of that, as we found out with Tace, who's feeling a little under the weather, we have this is sort of unique cruise for me in that we only have a couple of the scientists who have been out to sea before. We have the majority of the science party has never been on a deep water expedition. And so there's a lot, we're covering a lot of basics and really just talking about, you know, life at sea and the pace of how the days are going to go. And yes, you know, eating well and getting your rest now, because when we start 24-hour operations with the ROV, it's going to be really intense and the available time for sleep is kind of limited.
Well, I hope there's a lot of ginger on board for all those first timers on deep sea expeditions and that will adjust real quickly. Well, so let's talk a little bit more about the science goals of the expedition. You know, there's a lot of prep work, and, you know, we know you're going to be using an ROV to dive on these new areas, but what do you hope to find and what specifically are you going to be looking for?
Well, most of my work revolves around deep sea corals and their distribution, their physiology, their genetics, and their relationship to one another. So most of the focus of the cruise will be on the corals themselves. We're trying to gather data that will help inform the management of this gigantic protected area. And so just knowing what species of corals are present, how different each of the seamounts are from one another, how unique these communities are in terms of the corals of the entire Pacific, you know, those kinds of things will go a long way to help make decisions about when there are you know, economic and industrial pressures in these areas, and they do exist, even in the deep sea, more and more these days. You need to have the baseline data and the context and a good understanding of these organisms and their distribution to be able to make wise choices. So, you know, that's really the number one goal is exploration, but it's not a simple fishing expedition. It's, you know, very specifically to document and assess these communities to inform management. But then we have a number of other projects going on. We are looking at the relationships between the corals and the species that they create habitat for. So there are a lot of different brittle stars and different types of crabs that use the corals as their homes, and they have symbiotic relationships with the corals. And we've been discovering that these are mutualistic symbioses, which means that both parties, the crab and the host coral, get something out of it, that they're benefiting, that they may live longer, they may get more to eat, they may be able to reproduce more. You know, it benefits both of them when they have this relationship. And so we'll be looking at that more closely. We'll also be looking at the flip side of that, which is coral livery, so the species that feed on corals, and how the corals react to that, how they protect themselves, how it changes their physiology, how they may recover from that, how it changes the microbial communities that live alongside them, all those different aspects. And then we have some really cool new technology development that we're trying to do, that we're trying to push forward. We have a camera that can image fluorescence on the seafloor. So a lot of people are familiar with the bioluminescence in the ocean and, you know, bioluminescent bay, and you see it at night sometimes washing up on the beach. You see these little glowing things that are in there, and corals are bioluminescent sometimes. They create their own light, but there's also biofluorescence, and that means that the light that's making it down into deep waters, even 100 to a few hundred meters down, can react with the corals and their tissues and make them glow different colors. And we can perceive some of that, but the really cool thing that we have is a camera that can perceive the same wavelength of light that a fish would see and that a shark would see. And so if the corals are giving off light that maybe we can't see, but these other species can see, maybe they can find them. And we know that there are a lot of sharks that use corals as nursery grounds. They go in and they lay eggs, they attach their egg cases to corals. And it's possible that it's that fluorescence and their perception of fluorescence that allows them to have that relationship with the coral. So we'll be exploring that a little further with some really newly developed imaging systems. And then the final piece of technology development is, it's fun to say, these are the squishy fingers. So a lot of robotics these days are going towards soft robotics. And so these replace the hard, you know, titanium or aluminum metal, anyway, I'm not sure exactly what material they're made out of, the manipulator hands of the submersible that we use to pick things up off the seafloor. If you're picking up very brittle corals, they can break very easily in the manipulator, and it's very difficult to get a sample. But these are squishy fingers that can wrap around the coral and can help collect it and keep it intact until we can get it up to the surface. And so we'll be trying out some different kinds of soft manipulators. We have a 3D printer out here that we can print new fingertips for them and try different shapes and different configurations. And we're trying to help develop that technology for the undersea robots of the future. So primarily some exploration to help with the management, but we're sneaking in some really cutting-edge science into this project as well.
Well, it sounds like you're going to have a very busy cruise. There's a lot going on there. And this information, I'm curious to know, how will this help to better protect the Phoenix Islands area? And why is looking at this deep ocean area so important?
Well, there are a lot of there are a lot of connections between the deep sea and the shallow water areas, and we're really just beginning to understand them. We've known for a long time that the deep sea and deep sea corals get their food from shallow, from the productivity at the surface of the ocean. But we're really learning more and more that there are a lot of creatures that go down into the deep sea and interact with these habitats. They may feed, they may breed in these areas, and then return to the surface. And some of these organisms do this every single day. So at night, they may be at the surface feeding or taking advantage of some of the surface productivity. And then during the day, they can migrate down hundreds of meters. And increasingly, we're discovering that they may migrate thousands of meters. So there may be some species of fish and some small crustaceans, some shrimp, that go 2 kilometers from the surface down into the deep sea and back every single day of their life. And who knows what they're doing down there, but they are definitely interacting with these habitats on the bottom, and they are forming this bridge, this really tight connection between shallow and deep. So for a long time, the deep sea has sort of been, you know, out of sight, out of mind. But everything, as you know really well, everything in the ocean is connected. And we're really just starting to discover how strong those connections are. And what, from a management perspective, what is really important, but also what really sort of scares me, is that we don't know what all those connections are. That if we were to lose some of these species or some of these habitats in the deep ocean, the fact is that we don't know the consequences. And so until we really understand them and we understand these ties, we can't be going down there and exploiting some of these resources that, that may impact these communities, because we could be cutting off a really vital connection that supports the productivity of the whole ocean that, that feeds so many people on this planet, that people use and interact with directly. And until we understand all the complexity of that web and all those connections, we could be doing ourselves a lot of harm by impacting these communities in the deep ocean.
Well, well said. I could not have said that better myself. I'm very excited to hear more about this expedition, and it's amazing how clear you're coming in as you're sailing from Honolulu all the way out to the middle of the Pacific. So we really appreciate you taking some time to connect with us. We're going to take a quick break. We're going to explore more about this exciting expedition to the Phoenix Islands protected area.
Quarterback looking, firing across the middle. Wow, what a grab in traffic. Larson really had defenders hanging all over, but somehow he comes up with the football.
On the football field, you've got to stay focused and not get distracted.
NFL Hall of Famer and President and CEO of CTIA, the Wireless Association, Steve Largent.
The same is true on the road. So before your wireless phone becomes a distraction, take a time out for safety. Place your phone in easy reach before you leave. Never take notes or look up a phone number while you're driving. In bad weather or traffic, call later. Dial sensibly and use a hands-free device. You know, your wireless phone can be your best safety tool to call for help, stop a crime, or help someone in need. However you use it, remember, with wireless, safety is your call.
The wireless industry reminds you to drive safely. For more information, visit www.wirelesssafety.org.
If you're just joining us, I'm Carly Weiner, the Marine Science Gal, and today we are talking about an expedition currently underway aboard Schmidt Ocean Institute's research vessel, Falkor. The vessel is currently heading to the Phoenix Islands Protected Area to study the deep corals. We are talking with Dr. Eric Cordes, who's the principal investigator and associate professor and vice chair of biology at Temple University. Eric, thanks again for taking some time to talk to us today. Hi, Eric. Are you with
us now?
Hi,
Carly. We're calling back.
Excellent. So
I
glad
am. Here
that
I am.
You could connect with us. We're just rolling with the punches here. You know, the ocean is unpredictable. And here we are back on the program. So,
well, Eric, we're talking through a satellite and we're moving at about 10 knots and the seas are bumping around a little bit. So, you know, we're making it work.
Well, you're coming in loud and clear, so that's wonderful. Can you tell us,
Great.
Now, you had mentioned a little bit about the Phoenix Islands protected areas and the seamounts. Now, I had read somewhere that there are 25 underwater volcanoes located within the protected area. Are any of these active, and how do they influence the biology that you might find in, while you're doing your dive?
So these, the volcanoes are inactive as far as we know. We were joking that it would be just spectacular if we saw one that was actually erupting, but we think that they've been inactive for 10 to 20 million years. So the probability of seeing that's probably a little slim. But we do know that on volcanoes and on rocks of different ages, we can have very different coral communities. It takes a very long time for the rocks themselves to sort of age and to develop, you know, the right sort of crust on them, the right microbes to get the corals to come settle on them. And you see really different coral communities on different aged seamounts. And so that's where we may see some of the effect of the volcanoes and the different ages. I mean, who knows if one were to be erupting, and we've certainly had some surprises before. It would be more similar to like a hydrothermal vent where you would get, you know, sulfur coming out of the seafloor. You get totally different communities then, and some really weird communities. There was a volcano in the Central Pacific that was just full of eels that was discovered a while back, and we still are not entirely sure why that was, but there all sorts of very strange things could be awaiting us. That's the miracle of exploration.
Well, it certainly adds an exciting element between new potential coral species and hydrothermal vents. You never know. I guess you never know what you're going to find when you go out there. So walk us through.
Yeah, you really don't.
Once you get on site, what happens? So for our listeners that aren't familiar with ROV Sebastian or with remotely operated vehicles, can you walk us through like a typical day at sea when you're on site?
Sure. So there's actually quite a bit that happens even before we get the ROV in the water. The first thing we will do is map the area. And for a lot of these, we don't even have the basic maps. And like just like if you were to go for a hike somewhere in the woods, you would want to know where you were going. We would be making a map, which we would do from the ship using the sonar system on the ship. We will map the seafloor. We will look for some unusual features, some really steep slopes on the mountainsides that the corals really like to live on. And while we're processing that and trying to lay a course for the ROV, we will be taking a bunch of water samples, and we'll be looking at the oceanography in the water overlying the seamounts. We're interested in looking at the pH and the chemistry to see how ocean acidification is progressing and whether certain types of corals that use one kind of calcium carbonate might be excluded from this area because of the low availability of carbonate. That happens at a certain depth in the ocean, and as more CO2 from the atmosphere makes its way into the ocean, that depth the sort of pH limit that corals can survive is getting shallower and shallower. And there has been no data and no samples in the deep waters in this area. So we'll be the first ones to collect that and take a look. But once we have our map and we know something of the oceanography, then we can put the ROV in the water. We get onto station. The ship uses what's called dynamic positioning. So it's basically a software system that runs the engines of the ship and keeps you in an exact GPS location. It's kind of magical, actually, the way that it works. It's really fascinating. So we can stay on exactly one spot. The deck crew and some of the ROV crew goes out and launches the ROV. We've packed it full of sampling gear and different kinds of containers to hold all of our samples. We're still working on that right now on our transit down there. And then the big A-frame on the back of the ship that's run by hydraulics picks the vehicle up and puts it in the water, and then it starts its transit down. We're going to start our dives at almost 2 miles down, about 3,000 meters or so, and it takes maybe an hour or two, closer to 2 hours, to get down to the seafloor. And once we're down there, we will start our transit. It's much easier to climb up the mountain than it is to go back down. You can see more, and you can see sort of what's ahead of you if you go up. So we'll be literally climbing a mountain with a remotely operated vehicle, taking samples along the way, taking water samples, coral samples, samples of the associated animals living with the corals all along the way, and then bring them up when everything's full. We'll be doing, of course, some of the imaging using those different types of manipulators to collect some of these animals, and then the work in the lab starts when we get back up. So it's a long process, but what's really exciting about the Falkor and doing research out here on this vessel is that we get to share that with everybody. We have telepresence capabilities, which means that people can participate remotely. So we have a bunch of scientists on land that will be watching the video in real time, that can talk to us in real time. And everyone in the general public can tune in, can watch these dives, can ask us questions, can really, you know, be a part of the exploration and maybe see things that we missed and you know, tell us that something's happening there, that we've got a lot to do. We're trying to take notes. We're talking to people. We're talking to the pilots. You know, sometimes people on land will see things that we don't. And, you know, it's great to have as many eyes on it as possible to make sure that we use every second of this precious time out here as best we can.
And I think there's something so incredible about being able to be on shore and anyone in the public watching at the same time you are, looking at what's happening. And so anyone who's interested in watching these dives and seeing these discoveries in places no one has ever been before, they can follow along at Schmidt Ocean on our Facebook page or on the YouTube page. And that will be starting on around October 14th, but we'll always put out notifications. And Randy will definitely be narrating and talking about what they're seeing sporadically throughout the dives. Does that put pressure on you, Randy? Or are you excited to share that with the public?
I can turn it over to Randy, and we can talk a little more about the Phoenix Islands and the protected area and the public's involvement and the goals of the mission. So hold on just a second. Here she is.
That sounds great. Hi, Carly.
Hi, Randy. So we were just talking with Eric, and we were explaining a little bit about how a regular day, you would say, goes, even though there's no regular day at sea, with diving and how samples will be explored and collected and live streaming. So tell us a little bit about, for you, how does that feel to be able to share those dives in real time with the public, and what are you hoping or anticipating to see during these live streams?
Oh, that's a great question. For me, the really exciting piece about just being able to share this with the public is getting the Phoenix Islands Protected Area on the map, getting exploration on the map, and really sort of helping to showcase the importance of marine conservation in the Pacific, and let people see firsthand what these large protected areas are protecting. I think that these protected areas were put into place often around shallow objectives, but of course contain this huge deep sea habitat. And so for everyone, and I mean everyone who wants to see in real time, you know, what these protections are actually protecting down there, is this going to be in a really exciting context. You also, could you remind me the second part of your question?
Yeah, just kind of what you're anticipating from the dives and how it feels to be live streaming in real time and sharing what you're seeing with the public.
I'm so excited. I think it's going to be great. You know, I think one of the things about live streaming is that the joy of discovery is something that can belong to everybody at the same time, right? It's not prepackaged, it's not canned, and sometimes there's probably a little bit of a lot of I don't know or what is that, and I think that's really exciting for people to see the process, but not only, you know, what we see, but the process by which we determine what we see and what it means. So I'm pretty excited about being able to share that and being able to be a part of it. And I've been on the other side. I've been listening from home, and this is my first time in the deep sea, being right here at the site of discovery. So it'll be nice to experience it from both ends.
And as a mother of two, I mean, how exciting is that for your two young ones at home to be watching what you're going to be discovering in real time? And what kind of role model as a female in science do you think you play in being able to take part in some of these discoveries?
You know, I watched the Okeanos expedition at home, and some of it from home and some of it from my office, and participated using the telepresence technologies. And I had my two little kids on my lap for part of it, and which are almost 3 and almost 6. And I thought it was fantastic to be able to see it through their eyes as well, right? Really watch them struggle through that we were seeing an ecosystem that nobody had ever seen before. And I'm excited to sort of hear their excitement this time around too. As for mommy being away for a month, I think that's going to be hard on kids, and as it would always be. And it's just as hard on me as it is on them. But the reason to leave for a month is because this is important. I think it's really hard to explain that if you're never on the ocean, you're just not there at the site of discovery. You just can't. There's just sometimes you just have to go. And this is a place I've worked for so long and means so much to me personally as well as professionally that it's really an honor to be here. But it's even better that they're going to be able to watch it from home instead of just having to wait a month until I get back. So it's great.
Well, and it's certainly an important piece of it. And Eric was able to touch a little bit about where the Phoenix Islands are and, you know, the importance of their protection. But we didn't really hear a lot about how they became protected. Can you tell me a little bit more about how they became a protected area and one of the largest in the world, in fact?
I can. You know, it's a really interesting story, actually, and it's a story of just how a few people can really change the world. I used to work for the New England Aquarium, which is sort of where was the genesis of this entire project. Greg Stone, who now works for Conservation International, but at the time worked for the New England Aquarium, was part of a project called the Primal Oceans Project, where they were looking for spots in the ocean that were evocative of pre-human times, right? Really, without any human disturbance. And he hooked up with a boat owner based in Fiji, Rob Burrell of the Naya, and they planned their first expedition to the Phoenix Islands because they knew that no one had ever explored them before underwater. And it was all shallow scuba diving. And they went, and they thought it was spectacularly beautiful. And as part of the permit that they had received from the Republic of Kiribati, they told the capital city, Tarawa, what they had found. They said, you know, this is an incredible place. Do you know how amazing it is? And Tarawa and Kiribati, the Kiribati government said, actually, you know, no, we haven't really been there. Tell us about it. And Greg did and organized a second expedition. And it was becoming very clear that this place was special. just an incredible abundance of fishes and corals. And species that were typical, were once typical throughout the Pacific, but have been overfished almost everywhere else. And in the Phoenix Islands, we're still there in fairly high abundance. And with no resident population for throughout most of the archipelago, it's an opportunity to look at all of these natural systems in their natural state, which is, you know, increasingly rare. So President Tong and Greg had a long conversation about this, and there a bunch of different mechanisms floated, but at the end of the day, the decision was made to try to create the legal infrastructure within the government of Kiribati to create a marine protected area, right? At the time, all this became an idea. There wasn't even a legal infrastructure in place. So we brought in some lawyers from the Conservation Law Foundation and worked with Kiribati and some international partners, including Conservation International, the Aquarium, and some others, to build the protected area and make it a real thing. So it became implemented in 2008. And it was a phased approach to closure. So the idea is that only originally the 12 nautical miles surrounding each island would be fully protected. And it was mostly protection against shark finning, which had been happening prior to closure, and against any damage to the tropical coral reef systems, as well as to protect seabirds and the terrestrial environment. And then the hope was that over time, they would raise enough money through a mechanism called the conservation contract, which was held by a different body, the PIPA Trust, in order to try to raise enough money to close the whole thing. In 2010, the protected area became the largest and deepest UNESCO World Heritage Site, which is a special designation for really special natural places on our planet. And then in January 1st, 2015, the entire protected area closed to extraction, with the exception of allowing sustainable fishing by the population of Canton Island, which is about 25 people who live there. And so now, the entire protected area, this entire place the size of California, has no tuna fishing, no shark finning, no coral extraction, no nothing, just is allowed to be. And it's, you know, it's this very large space, and it was one of the first to really implement this this level of protection across so many different ecosystems. Prior to the creation and implementation of the Phoenix Islands, the only very large marine protected area out there was the Great Barrier Reef, which was implemented, I believe, in 1977 or 78. And then PIPA and then Papahanaumokuakea both came into play at the same time, roughly. And then now the idea is that everyone's hoping to get 30% of the oceans protected by 2030. And so there's a huge, wonderful race to conserve and protect the oceans. But even though PIPA has been protected for less than a decade, this makes us one of the oldest MPAs out there. And so we are continually trying to innovate and use science as part of the conversation with management and really make it a two-way conversation. And keep trying new things to make sure that this special place stays special.
That is such an incredible story. And actually, I'm embarrassed to say I did not know that story. And I'm sitting here with goosebumps. It's just so inspirational and incredible, and so excited that you guys are heading there to really contribute to the science. I want to hear more about the Phoenix Islands Protected Area and your role on the ship. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll talk more about Phoenix Islands Protected Area and the current expedition.
You mean I could have diabetes and not even know it?
Then why would I want to know?
Heart disease, amputations, stroke, blindness can all be caused by diabetes. So it's critical that you know. If you're over 45, you don't exercise, and you're overweight, you're at risk. But a simple blood test can detect the problem, and with early treatment, you can prevent the devastating effects of diabetes. Call the American Diabetes Association at 1-800-DIABETES. Don't be blind to diabetes.
Mom?
Dad?
How long should I wait for you?
Mom?
If I'm at soccer practice.
What if something happens? Will you come get me?
There's no reason not to have a plan in case of a terrorist attack.
Mom, if you're not home, should we go to the neighbor's house?
And some extremely good reasons why you should.
Can you tell me?
Everybody should have a plan. Take 5 minutes to talk about where you'll meet and how you'll get in touch with each other in an emergency. For other things you can do to be prepared, visit www.ready.gov. A public service announcement brought to you by the U.S. Department of Homeland Security and the Ad Council.
Welcome back. If you're just joining us, I'm Carly Weiner, the Marine Science Gal, and today we are talking about the Feet Silence Protected Area, an expedition currently underway with Schmidt Ocean Institute's research vessel, Falkor. We've had the distinct pleasure of talking with Randy, a research assistant professor at Boston University in the Department of Biology, who is on the expedition and co-principal investigator. So, Randy, you just illuminated an amazing history of the development of the Phoenix Islands Protected Area and why it's so special. How does this research expedition play into your personal focus and work, and what will you be looking for or collecting on the dive?
Yeah, I'd be happy to talk about that. So I just want to maybe put a little bit of science history into the history of the protected area that we just sort of articulated, and to share that I joined the team in 2008, and in 2010 we held our very first science meeting. Up until then, David Obura, who's based out of Kordio in Kenya, had done a wonderful job of describing the sites, along with Sangeeta Mungubai, who is with the Wildlife Conservation Society in Fiji. And they described the sites and laid out a basic monitoring program. But in 2010, we changed gears a little bit and went from monitoring to continuing monitoring, but also to putting in hypothesis testing and to an exploration into our science plan. And so we're, you know, almost 8 years into that 10-year plan. And back in 2010, we identified exploration of the deep sea habitat as one of the top priorities for this protected area because we knew nothing about it. And so over time, I've founded a science advisory committee and now co-chair it with Tukubu Tararoko, based in Tarawa, who's also the director of the Phoenix Islands Protected Area Office. And what we do is we take these scientific priorities and we liaise them with the management of the protected area. And every year we check in, and every year up until now we've had to say, yep, we still have this deep sea exploration priority, but we don't know anything yet. And then, wow, 2017 has been the year for deep sea exploration in this protected area. First with the NOAA Okeanos Explorer, and now it's here with the Falkor. And so this expedition really marks the turning point from knowing nothing to knowing a little to maybe even knowing, well, I won't go so far as to say knowing a lot, but knowing a lot more than we have ever known before, and to really targeting this priority that we identified almost a decade ago. And so for me, I'm on board with Arante Takiao, who I'm sorry is a little under the weather and can't make this call, but he's a representative of Kiribati who's been working with me since 2010, and it works for the Department of Fisheries. And the two of us are excited because we've both participated in a lot of the shallow water work. As a coral reef scientist, I've really been invested in the climate change story and how these El Nino events are impacting shallow reef corals. But Pace and I just keep looking at each other and thinking, oh my gosh, we're finally here. We're finally able to see what lies well below the surface and maybe even draw some connections between the shallow and the deep water environment. So for me, this cruise really represents almost a decade of work and thought and prioritizing. And it's going to be, I know what's going to happen, though, is that at the end of it, it's going to lead to another 10 years of questions, at least.
It usually does. And Randy, you know, for those of us listening here in Hawaii and are excited to follow along the expedition and so curious about the connectivity between all of our Pacific islands and protected areas, what are some similarities or differences that you anticipate to see in the waters there in the Phoenix Islands versus what we would see maybe here in Hawaii or in the Papahanaumokuakea Marine National Monument?
Well, the first thing that comes to mind is latitude. So the Phoenix Islands, you know, basically are just below the equator, and that puts them in a completely different oceanographic regime than, you know, Hawaii or the Northwest Hawaiian Islands. But the second is really just the type of islands that they are. I mean, Hawaii, we were leaving the dock yesterday, and, you know, for hours you could see the stunning relief of these very high islands. And the Phoenix Islands are all low-lying atolls, so they're fundamentally different shapes, and they have different processes and ecological processes going on and different kind of terrestrial influence in the land and from the land and the sea and vice versa. And so I'm really looking forward to seeing seeing the atoll influence on these various ecosystems as we climb these mountains, as Eric described earlier. And in addition, I think I think, all protected areas for the most part, right, of doing what they can to mitigate human influence. But the Phoenix Islands have never been fully settled. The majority of these eight islands have never had anybody living on them. And so in some ways, they're similar to the Northwest Hawaiian Islands, which are also very remote and have been sparsely inhabited and sparsely exploited. And that's actually why the Phoenix Islands has a sister site agreement with Papahanaumokuakea to really highlight those similarities. But the differences in latitude and in ocean currents and proximity in the Pacific are going to be very different. And so it'll be really neat to do the compare and contrast at the end.
Absolutely. And, you know, one of the things that I'm really inspired by is that you guys are not just going there to do the science, but you are going to be visiting some of the small group of caretakers that are there and bringing some provisions. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Absolutely. So in this California-sized box, there are roughly 25 people, which every time I think about that, I just think about no traffic in California. But anyway, the 25 people live on one island, and they are living in a lot of peace and a lot of quiet, and with a supply boat that only comes irregularly and, you know, every few months. And so every chance we go out there, it's an opportunity to bring some much-needed supplies and also some things for fun to sort of just, you know, as a gesture of welcome and in ancient Polynesian tradition of showing up with some, you know, something to offer, and also just because this is a place full of people that we love and know and who are working so hard to keep this protected area protected. You know, some of the inhabitants of that island are kids, so we always send art supplies and workbooks and things for kids to do too, which is really fun. They have a small school on the island, and so I'm really looking forward to seeing the kids and seeing their reaction when we present them with a bunch of new things to play with, which, I don't know, if they're anything like my kids, they'll be pretty excited.
Absolutely. And how do you see the science that's going to be collected helping the people of Kiribati?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think what helps the most is it really helps to keep the protected area grounded in what it's protecting. You know, it's easy to draw lines in a map. It's not that easy, actually. I'll give a lot of credit to the people who have drawn the lines on that map and to the people who have maintained them. But those lines have become meaningful when you know what's inside of them. And for Kiribati, you know, they have a lot of ocean. You know, the Phoenix Islands represents roughly only 1/6 of their total EEZ, or exclusive economic zone. And so it can serve as a baseline for the surrounding area and what might be able to be visible or used in adjacent waters. But it also serves this really important and almost ancient cultural philosophy for the Polynesian Islands, which is to be caretakers of the ocean. And I think it's really neat to be among the people who help to figure out what everyone is caretaking. And so what is protected. And in terms of helping the people more directly, I think it's also worth mentioning that the PIPA Trust has created a new initiative called the Bring PIPA Home Initiative. I mean, most people who live in Kiribati will never get to see the Phoenix Islands because they're over 1,000 miles away from where they live. And so this act of having telepresence available and being able to archive all of the video, bring it with us, is one way to bring PIPA home. And then I would hope, I think as we all do, that as more and more students from Kiribati get involved in marine science and can, you know, receive the appropriate training and degree work and participate in expeditions and other scientific activities, that they will be able to make their future involve PIPA and, you know, understand the role of marine science in the functioning of the archipelago, their entire nation, and the Pacific. And I think that for a seafaring culture and history and a group of people who live so closely connected to the sea, I mean, it's a really logical extension of what they see on the surface to what's going on below.
And how, you know, I love the management applications of this science, but how will what you find affect future monitoring? And do you expect to see any bleaching? Has there been any bleaching in this region before? Or are you focusing on deeper coral areas, so that's not really of a concern?
You know, it's hard for me to talk about the management implications in the deep sea because we don't know what we're going to find, and because the Phoenix Islands are protected from the deep sea perspective. So hopefully there isn't much more management of the deep sea environment except to keep it protected. Although, of course, there's always the potential for mining in the region, and this will at least shed some light on the biology and the geology of the region, which I think can be really helpful from a conservation perspective or from an application perspective. But I do think that the story in the shallow water is a little easier to tell, mostly because we know more. So, for example, we've been learning over the years that places with shipwrecks have not recovered as well from bleaching as places without shipwrecks, because shipwrecks are introducing iron into the ocean in a place that's typically very iron poor. And so it's really starting the conversation about whether or not we need to launch a shipwreck removal program, which is a management issue, but it's really coming as a result of the scientific discovery that the Phoenix Islands has a lot of shipwrecks. The corals are vulnerable to bleaching, but the ones that have corals in areas with shipwrecks are the most vulnerable and show the least propensity to recover quickly. So I think the nice thing about science is that it can lead you anywhere, and the hard thing about science is that it can lead you anywhere. And so we'll have to see where we get led this time and what it might mean for the implications for the future.
Excellent. Well, that's a great answer, Randy. And what about you? What's next for you after this expedition? Is your work strictly on the Phoenix Islands, or do you get to incorporate a lot of different projects of science into your day-to-day?
Well, so what's next for me after this expedition? The very first thing I'm going to do is go run home and hug my sweet children. But I really have two big programs going on in my laboratory. One is the Phoenix Islands Protected Area, which I work on soup to nuts. So I have projects going on with larval plankton and larval fishes in the area, larval corals that were collected from the Open Ocean Oceanography perspective in collaboration with SEA, which is the Sea Education Association, and with Woods Hole Oceanographic. I'm a shallow coral biologist, so I have lots of projects going on looking at coral resilience and coral bleaching and collaborations with other institutions as well on that. And then now we'll have this deep sea portion. But I'm also an ecophysiologist, and it's very hard to do any experiments or really sort of drill down and look at the physiology in a place as remote as the Phoenix Islands. So I work on a local temperate coral, local to me, so it's from the New England area, where we can really manipulate symbiosis, and we can really use it to understand the processes that a tropical coral can go through, but we do it in a temperate coral model. And so all that we learned from the Phoenix Islands, I try to apply to my temperate model system, and all that we learned from our temperate model system, I try to bring back to the Phoenix Islands. So it will be cold and snowy in wintertime in New England very, very soon, and I will hold on to this tropical memory, but dig down and try to go through the data that we've collected and try to put it in the whole context of the Phoenix Islands, as well as use it to inform my next set of experiments for next summer.
Well, I love that incorporation and influence of the other science and what you're able to accomplish. And how often do you get out to the Phoenix Islands? Is this sort of like a one-time experience for you, or will there be other expeditions planned on different ships in the future?
So we've been able to get expeditions out there reasonably regularly for a place so far away. You know, as a woman in science who's had babies recently, I will admit that I haven't been out to sea probably as much as I should have. But, you know, being pregnant on a boat that's tipping, I think, would amplify seasickness beyond my ability to tolerate it. But I definitely have been involved in every expedition, very deeply involved and carefully involved with all the expeditions that have gone out recently, participating either by telepresence or satellite, and certainly setting up all of the scientific work and all of the logistics, and making sure to translate back and forth between science and management. So SEA has been going out annually since 2014, and so they'll have their next expedition going out this summer. And we've had shallow reef coral expeditions going out roughly every 3 years, and we're hoping to put another one together this coming May. And we will see if I'm on that one or not. It'll depend a lot on timing and children, but I will certainly try. But being involved with the expeditions is really exciting, and this is not my first trip to the Phoenix Islands, but it will be my first trip looking at the deep sea.
Well, Randy, we're so excited. Thank you so much for making some time to be here today and tell us about the expedition. I'd like to give a special thanks to all of our guests and our sponsors, the Hawaii Institute of Marine Biology. I'm Carly Weiner. Now get out there and enjoy our ocean planet.